Okay, so if you would please turn to the book of Job. Last week I tried to provide you with an introduction to what we're going to be seeing, context for not just this book, but for all of the five books that are in what we could call the wisdom section of the Bibles that we use. We looked last time at chapter 1, so today what I would like to do is review very, very quickly. In the first verse, you're introduced to Job. It is my sense, I can't prove this, but it is my sense that this book was written to be performed on a stage. That this was written to have a narrator who spoke from the wings, and then things take place on the stage. Things take place out of sight and are commented on the stage. I think that, and I'll try to show you why. My suspicion is that stage would not have been indoors. It would have been outdoors because of some things that happened late in the book. So here you have a narrator, and the narrator introduces you to Job. Where he is from is not known, but thought to be part of Edom to the east of Israel. And in my first, in that first verse of Job 1, he's described as a sound and honest man who feared God and shunned evil. Whatever yours says there, look for that phrase and sort of note it. It tells about his wealth and his possessions. It tells about his children. It tells about what the children did to stay connected. What did they do to stay connected? This is a pop quiz because you had this last week.
They had a
series of meals together. They called them banquets, but they would go, and it doesn't say what the time period was, maybe once a month. I'll do the best I can. If I talk too loud, I start to cough, and that is a serious issue. Would sitting here make you hear better?
I don't think so.
Because you could. Okay, in any event, they had a series of meals together, and after each series of meals, he would bring everybody to his house, and we believe before the law was given, he did what the law commanded. He would purify his sons, and then he would offer sacrifice. And if you look at what it says, this is at the middle of verse 5, a very long verse, he says, I'm doing this just in case. Mine says, perhaps one of them has sinned. And so, just in case, we're taking the steps to make sure that if there's any sin, it's all dealt with. And then it ends, verse 5 ends with, that was what Job used to do each time, each cycle. Verse 6 shifts gears. You have a sense of the narrator saying, one day, and about that time the stage lights come up. And what do you see when the stage lights come up? Verse 6. What do you see? You see God's throne room in heaven. And who else is there? It says, the sons of God came to attend on the Lord. And some translations say among them. And some translations say along with them came Satan. Where have you been? My translation uses the word prowling around, which I think is about as good as you can get.
Roaming,
your says, which I don't think is quite strong enough.
Trolling
is a... Oh, but trolling would be better. Okay. Prowling around. Roaming around there. And God says, did you notice? Mine says, did you pay attention to my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth. And then he describes Job to Satan. And what are the words he uses? The same words the narrator used back in chapter 1. Back in verse 1. Are we okay? You see that so far? And Satan says, well, why wouldn't he? Look what he gets out of it. I'm paraphrasing. Haven't you put a wall of protection around him? Look at Isaiah 5 for a description of what that wall is like. Right. You've put a hedge of protection around him, we could say. You've protected everything. So why wouldn't he? You've given him all this stuff. He's doing it because of what he gets out of it. And God says, okay, All he has is in your power, but keep your hands off his person. And Satan left the presence of God. What happens very shortly thereafter? I sense the lights are dropped. You don't see God's throne room anymore. You have the narrator standing to the side who begins to talk again. And he begins to describe one day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking in the oldest brother's house. What happened? Ruth fell in and killed them all. What else happened? Raiding armies took all of his flocks. Fire falls from heaven and burns up the sheep. Camels taken away by the Chaldean mercenaries. Verse 20 and verse 21, what does Job do? He sits down in abject and outward mourning, and he begins to speak. And when he finishes speaking, he says at the end, "The Lord has given, the Lord has taken back. Blessed be the name of the Lord." I think you're allowed to see that. I think the stage lights come up and you get to see Job hearing these reports. You don't see the things happening. You see Job, and you see the one servant comes in and tells him about the camels are lost, the sheep are lost, this is lost, and it's the last of the reports. All of your children are dead. And Job sits down and weeps. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken back. Blessed be the name of the Lord. What's the narrator's comment as the lights are dimming? I'm looking at verse 22. Are you? What does he say? In all this, he did not sin. Somebody had something.
Yes. 20, I love the way it ends here. Job arose, tore his clothes, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and worshipped. Literally, I have the word worship.
That's a great word. Mine says prostrated himself, which is the position of worship. Worshipped is a better word there, I think. Hi, Becky. It's nice to have you back. I didn't realize that. Yeah. Verse 1. All the lights go out. What do you see? Just the narrator in a spotlight. On another day, you're back. The lights come back up. You're back in God's throne room. I don't know if this is how it's presented, but I'm inviting you to begin to look at this in that way, because I think some things will come alive if you do this. And what do you see? You see the same scene you saw before. Satan came with him, almost the same words. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you been?" Same answer, prowling around on earth, roaming around there. Whatever it said before, it ought to say the same thing again in your translation. So the Lord asked him, almost the same words, "Did you pay attention? Did you notice my servant Job? Nobody like him on earth." Same phrase, a sound and honest man who fears God and shuns evil. And then he adds, he persists in, my translation uses the word integrity, still. You achieved nothing by provoking me to ruin him. Man, I don't understand that. And I'm not going to go into that swamp. But there you have it. Satan provokes God into ruining him. I don't think I want to touch that one. I'll just simply let it sit. Whatever was going on between the two of them, it went on. And Satan replies, skin after skin, or something like that, which is an ancient cliche with deep meaning. Basically, he's saying, you've only let me touch his possessions. Let me touch his body, and it'll work. What is Satan's most prominent characteristic? The convincing lie. He had said, "You let me touch his possessions, he'll curse you to his face." That didn't work. He's already wrong. So he comes back and says, "Yeah, you know, possessions really didn't matter. It's just, let me touch his body." And God says,
"That's not his life."
Okay, but you can't kill him. At the end of verse 6, Satan left the presence of the Lord, and what happens to poor Job? He has the most awful diseases fall on him, all of which have an outward manifestation. You can see the ulcerated, pus-filled sores that cover him. That picture in verse 8 is horrible. He sits down and scrapes at them because they itch so much, I guess. His wife says, give it up. Curse God and die. Rabbi Zacharias has written extensively about this. I have put a link to that page in the online lesson area. I invite you to go read. It's 26 pages long. Take your time. It's worth the trip. But he says at one point, what does curse God and die really mean? It means slipping on tennis shoes and go kick a tank. That's basically what it means. It's going to do no good. Maybe it'll make you feel better. At least your toe will hurt and it'll take your mind off whatever else is happening. What was his response? The Lord gives. The Lord has taken back. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That was his first response. What's his response here? This is verse 10. Chapter 2, verse 10. If we take happiness from God's hand, must we not take sorrow too? Implied, if he offers it. And in all this misfortune, Job uttered no sinful word. And that's the end of the prologue. The lights go down, the narrator steps back onto the stage, spotlight comes on, and he begins to say, the news of all the disasters that had fallen on Job came to the ears of three of his friends. Each of them set out from home, and it names the three. Who's the first one? Let's practice this. Eliphaz. Who's the second one? Bildad. I have been signing my notes to my children, my emails to my children with Bildad. I think that's it. I've decided that's what I'm going to do for a while. I'm known as Papa Bill, but somehow Bildad seems to me almost as good. And who's the last guy?
Zophar.
Zophar, we're doing okay, but who knows about tomorrow. What can you learn by the order in which these names are given?
I'm not sure.
Which one would be listed first? Probably the most prominent. Most prominent means probably the oldest. Which one would be listed last? Probably the youngest. I think it's interesting, almost all the commentators take that position. Eliphaz is the old one, Bildad is middle age, Zophar is young. And I think it's fascinating that here's a man who is probably old, who has young friends. By the time my parents died, most of their friends had already died. And yet the funeral was packed. It was packed with younger folks, all the way down to in their 20s and 30s, that had been befriended in some way without my mom and dad consciously thinking about it. It was just who they are. I'm hoping that you have somebody in your family that you can look to that has that sort of thing. They, by common consent, they decided to go and offer him sympathy and consolation. If they weren't living in the same place, it would have taken a while to talk to each other. So we don't know how much time has elapsed. But the narrator tells us, here they came. Verse 12, they saw him from a distance and they didn't recognize him. Why not? All the sores and ulcerations all over his body made him unrecognizable. They wept aloud, they tore their robes, they threw dust over their heads, and they did the most perfect thing they will ever do in the whole of the book. They sat without speaking for how long? 7 days, 7 nights. I'm nearly positive that you did not have to sit and watch that stage for 7 days and 7 nights. But I do think the lights are up, and you're seeing, coming in from a distance, see their reaction to Job, see them join Job. And sit in silence. I'm not positive this is true, but I think it's true. When you have someone who has had a horrible, horrible incident in their life, I will tell you parenthetically, I read through a whole bunch of our prayer lists. We have had some tough days among people in this group over the years. We have had some tough days. Some of you have been the ones who've had those tough days. I can remember going to a hospital one night down to VCU, and there was a person that wasn't expected to live through the night. They did, and they're functioning fine today, but that night, didn't know. And I remember I didn't say much, because there was very little I could say that would have done any good. But by being there, I was saying something, I think. And I think that's what these guys were doing. Their presence helped until they opened their mouth. That's the prologue. 7 days and seven nights to Job, they spoke never a word, for they saw how much he was suffering. Now that gets us to where we were last time. That only took 20 minutes, and it's very much worth it because we're back to setting the stage now. Starting at chapter 3, we begin a process that runs all the way to chapter 31. We now have a scene. What's in our scene? Tell me what you see on the stage. Because the narrator's about to step out off the stage. What do you see? Here sits Job, covered with sores and boils, scraping at them with a piece of broken pottery, maybe. Although that's a little metal dramatic. And what else? The three friends. Where did they face the three friends? They probably face you, because we're looking at this on the stage. You want to be able to hear their voices. When this actually happened, their backs would probably have been to you if you had been able to see it. But for a stage production, they're sitting there. Was it three on one side and Job on another? Probably. Was it two on one side, one on the other? I don't know. But there they sit. Chapter 3, verse 1. The words are powerful. In the end, it was Job who broke the silence. I think those are stage directions. I don't think the narrator said those words. I think Job just begins to speak. And what does he do? They tell you in verse 1, and then he does it over the next 15 or 20 verses. Curses the day he was born. And off we go. Now, if you look carefully at what follows, Job speaks for a chapter or two. And then one of the three friends speaks. Which one? Eliphaz. Why? He's the oldest. He gets priority. When he finishes speaking, Job speaks again. When he finishes speaking, who speaks now? Bildad. When Bildad finishes, Job speaks. When Job speaks, who follows? Zophar. When Zophar finishes, who starts? Job. So you see Job, Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, and what happens now? Job speaks again, the cycle starts again. 3 to 14 is the first cycle, 15 to 21 is the second cycle, 22 to 31 is the third cycle, and if it didn't matter what they say, we'd be through. In the last cycle, Zophar does not speak. So that's going to take us up to chapter 31. All right? I have 17 pages of notes, and that will take us through chapter 14, and we will try to do as much of that as we can today. Sound good? No, it's not going to happen. Job broke the silence. The essence of what Job is saying you can find in verse 11. What does he say? Why wasn't I stillborn? Why didn't I die at birth? Or why didn't I die before I was born? Or why didn't I die as I was born? Verse 17, what does it say?
In death, there's
the silence of death has to be better than this. That's because you have to go all the way from 17 to 23 to see that. You have to read faster than that. If you start at verse 17 and read through verse 23, what you essentially see is the other half of what he said. Why was I even born? Why didn't I die before I was born, or at least die as I was born? Then starting in verse 17 and going through verse 23, he's basically saying death has got to be better than what I'm feeling and experiencing right now. The silence of death, he calls it in one place in there. The wicked bustle no more, the weary rest. Prisoners are left in peace, no more the shouts of the oppressors. High and low are there together. The silence of death has got to be better than this. And he finishes, because death isn't coming. In verse 26, there is no calm, there is no peace. My torments banish rest. Now who speaks?
Eliphaz.
And Eliphaz is? I'm trying to get you going on this.
He's
the first friend. Keep going. Probably the oldest of the friends. Probably the most experienced of those. And he's going to speak first. His opening sentence is fascinating. If we say something, would you let us? Who in any case could be silent now, given what you've just said? Verse 3 and 4 fascinate me. You have schooled many others, my translation says, giving strength to feeble hands. Your words supported any who wavered and strengthened every failing knee. And now your turn has come and you lose patience. First touch on yourself. Boy, this is way more than a first touch. The first touch on yourself and you're overwhelmed. Do you hear it? Skip down to verse 7. Verse 6 has said, doesn't your piety give you confidence? Doesn't your integrity of life give you hope? Verse 7, can you recall anyone guiltless that perished? That was ruined, you might say. Where then have the honest ever been wiped out? Now, what did he just say? You wouldn't be dealing with this if you were guiltless. You wouldn't be dealing with this if you were honest. Who's ever heard of such a thing? Time out. Who's ever heard of such a thing? Almost everybody, if they're honest. Do you hear Eliphaz's argument beginning to quiver a little bit? The foundation's not quite as strong as it might have looked. Verse 7. Can you recall anyone guiltless that perished? Where then have the honest ever been wiped out? Verse 8 is Eliphaz's motto. What does he say at the first of it? Earlier than that. The very first bit. According to what I've seen. Mine says, I speak from experience. I know what I'm talking about. You need to hear something like that. And you need to hear it almost in that tone. I know what I'm talking about. Which means what? He's looking at Job. Which means what?
You don't.
I know what I'm talking about. Parenthesis. You don't. Those who plow iniquity and sow disaster reap just that. You are reaping disaster. You are reaping horrible things. You must have been sowing it. That sounds correct, right? How many places in the Bible does it say something like that? Lots. It isn't that he's wrong. It is that it's not very helpful given Job's condition and given Job's circumstances. That's a big point you got to get to. Okay? What's he saying to Job? Clearly you've been doing wrong and you're getting what you deserve. Now I'm going to do something that may seem strange to you. I'm going to rush ahead. I want you to jump over to chapter 5, verse 1. Jump over to chapter 5, verse 1. Make your appeal then, he says. Think you're going to find an answer? To which of the holy ones, he's speaking here of angels, we think, to which of the holy ones will you turn? He's basically saying, you need to make an appeal to God. What does the word appeal suggest? when we have an appellate court. What does that imply?
Listen again.
There's been a conviction. You appeal after the conviction, right?
True.
That's what appellate courts are for. If you were acquitted, no need for an appeals court.
No.
This is for convictions. He's still persisting in, clearly you've been convicted. So your hope then is to make an appeal. Take a look at verse 6. He's now repeating himself. Misery does not grow out of the soil. Sorrow does not spring from the ground. It's people who breed trouble for themselves, just as surely as eagles fly to the height. If I were you, I would appeal to God and lay my case before him. Verse 11. I'm going to paraphrase to try to help you see what these verses are saying. You read them and let me paraphrase. God has been known to lift the downcast. Verse 15. He has been known to rescue the bankrupt. He has been known to rescue the needy from the grasp of the mighty. Verse 16. Hope springs afresh for the weak. Verse 17 is the big one. Blessed are those whom the Lord corrects. What is his conclusion about what has happened to Job? Job has been corrected. Corrected of what? Of misconduct, of misdeeds, of sin. Blessed are those whom the Lord corrects. So don't scorn the lessons of the Lord. For the one who wounds is the one who soothes the sore. The hand that hurts is the hand that heals. Six times he'll deliver you from sorrow, and the seventh time evil will not touch you. Is that true? That God may bring punishment, but he also will bring restoration after that. Lord knows that's true. That's the whole of what we were doing back in Jeremiah and Lamentations, looking forward those 70 years to when God was going to come in. It isn't that Eliphaz is wrong. He's mostly right. What's the problem? He's not helping. And it's not helping because it's not addressing the problem. So here's what I wrote. So far, so good. Much of what he has said rings true. God does lift up the fallen. He does heal. He does restore. So what's wrong with Eliphaz? Two things. Number one is his assumptions. What are his assumptions? I have three of them. God always blesses those who follow his ways. Assumption two. God always punishes those who don't follow his ways. Number three, now you apply it to Job. If you're suffering, it must be your fault. You must have done wrong. Let's do that again. What's the problem? Number one, his assumptions. What are his assumptions? First assumption, God blesses those who follow his ways. Assumption number two, he punishes those who do not, who rebel, who refuse to obey. Number three, if you're suffering, must be your fault. You must have done something wrong. I have not said that well. I need to alert you to this fact. I know I'm not saying it well. I'm doing that because I can't say it better yet. I gotta wait a little bit before I can say it better. What are the problems? Number one, his assumptions. Number two, the basis of his beliefs. What is the basis of Eliphaz's beliefs? Oh, no. Remember how we rushed ahead?
Yes, even the background people always felt.
Remember how we rushed ahead? Mm-hmm. Let's go back. I want to take you to verse 12, chapter 4, verse 12. How does it start? It starts spooky. It starts scary. And it gets worse. You are seeing the basis of Eliphaz's beliefs. His conclusion from those beliefs is not wrong, but boy, the basis for his beliefs is really, really strange. I have received a secret revelation. A whisper has come to my ears by night when dreams confuse the mind and slumber lies heavy on everyone. A shiver of horror ran through me and filled all my bones with fright. A breath slid over my face. The hairs on my body bristled. Someone stood there. I didn't know his face, but the form stayed there before my eyes. Silence, and then I heard a voice. Can a mortal seem upright to God? Would anyone seem pure in the presence of his Maker? How do you debate that? I saw a vision.
Sounds like something.
How do you debate that? No, it doesn't. Like Paul would write?
Poe,
yeah. I thought you said Paul.
No.
Poe, maybe.
Yeah.
How do you debate that? The basis of his belief is some spooky experience in the middle of the night when he didn't know what it was and where it was coming from. When you don't know what it's coming from, what it is and where it's coming from, it might not be coming from God. You don't know. The conclusion is pretty good. But I give you a little clue. If you look carefully, you see the flaw in his conclusion right here. We're only four chapters in, and that's all you need. That's all you need. I'm looking at verse 17 because this is the key verse in this whole section. Can a mortal seem upright before God? Would anyone seem pure in the presence of his Maker? What, friends, is the answer to that question?
Yes.
The answer is yes. And it's already happened. It happened in chapter 1. What did God say to Satan? Have you noticed my servant Job? Nobody like him on earth. A sound and honest man who fears God and shuns evil. Is that the judgment of impurity? Is that the judgment of sin and flaw? That's the judgment of uprightness and purity. This may be the most important thing I'm going to say in 3 weeks. His conclusion sounds right. In fact, that conclusion is repeated with power in Romans. All have sinned. All have come short of the glory of God. That's the same sentence. But that sentence is incomplete. And that's what Job is wrestling with.
His friends made the assumption that God was doing this to him. But in fact, God was not doing it. He allowed it.
I can't let that sit. Tail end of chapter 2, verse 3. I am bothered by it. I don't really want to delve into it, but I'm required to go back and read it with you again. Chapter 2, verse 3. God is speaking to Satan. There's no one like him on earth, he says of Job. Sound and honest man who fears God and shuns evil. He persists in his integrity still. You achieve nothing by provoking me to ruin him.
Says, he persuaded me to let you.
That may be better, but there is still a role that God is playing in this. I don't know what to do with that. And I can almost guarantee you don't either. This is really, really tough moment right here. But to somehow say, well, God's not doing it. God has no part in it. It's all Satan. I don't think that washes with what we see here. I don't know what to do with it. And I swear to you, Job didn't either. And that's what had him embroiled in knots. Job didn't either. Why do horrible things happen to good people? That's the big thing that has weighed on most human beings at most points in the history of the world. Is the foundation for belief and trust and assurance spooky voices in the night? I don't think that's a particularly good one. And what happens when you hear those voices is they get you close, but it's not quite right. And that difference is huge. And Job is wise enough to know that. Chapter 6, verse 1 says, Chapter 6, verse 1 says, Job spoke next, or Job replied. Do we have time to hear what Job had to say? Do we have time to hear what Job had to say? No, we do not. We are out of time. We are out of time. Therefore, what will we do? We will read the rest of Job. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And when will we do that? Before next Sunday. And when we come back, we will start at?
Chapter 6,
verse 1. Well, we'll probably back up and get a little running start because there'll be some people here who need that. Are we doing okay? You need to hear Job's reply. Because in each case, he is being challenged by people who are almost right. But it's that not quite that has Job saying, nope, that's not it. And rejecting their counsel as... In fact, in one place he says, I know everything you just said is true. And then you hear him say, paraphrased, but that doesn't work in this circumstance. We got to keep looking. And I want you to see the progression of Job, and you haven't even seen step one yet. But you've seen the foundation for it. So read Job, and we'll gather next week. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the chance to gather and look at your word. I pray more than anything that your spirit would be strongly present in this room, strongly present in the heart of each one of us participating, helping us to see what we need to see, helping us to see both the virtues and the flaws of each thing we read. We pray that your spirit would help us get a sense of the whole, of what Job needed to know and how he came to know, for that's the power of this book. He has come to know something that all of us need to know. We pray this and all of the things we have talked about earlier today in your Son's name. Amen.